Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
This is Nani Darwis, author of The Devil We Don't Know, The Dark Side of Revolutions in the Middle East. You're listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. The truth about the ideology of Islam is coming out every day. Do we perceive it? Well, not if we're expecting our politicians and our media to be the bearers of that truth. And that's why I asked my next guest to join us. For my new listeners, Dr. Andrew Bostom is an internationally renowned author, speaker, and broadcast media guest, an associate professor of medicine at the Warren Alpert School of Medicine at Brown University. Dr. Bostom's articles and commentaries on Islam can be read in such news outlets as the New York Post, the Washington Times, the New York Daily News, National Review Online, the American Thinker, PJ Media, Front Page Magazine, Family Security Matters, as well as other well-known online publications. Dr. Bostom is the author of several highly acclaimed books, including his newest book, Iran's Final Solution for Israel, The Legacy of Shiite Islamic Jew Hatred in Iran. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Dr. Andrew Bostom. Welcome back, Andy.
Thanks for having me on again, Audrey.
It's always great to have you with us, and we got a lot to talk about here, Andy. I want to backtrack a little because there are some listeners that may not be familiar with what this amendment was. Andy, can you please explain what the Corker-Cardin Amendment is?
Yes. So it's actually called, you can see it in the title of the bill, the amendment. It's called the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act of 2015. And I was very initially when I saw there was some opposition to Obama's whole, the administration's whole trajectory of negotiations with Iran, which I thought should never have gotten underway back in November of 2013, when we heard this horrible announcement that the process was underway, but there was really a high water mark reached about, I would say, 5 to 6 weeks before Corker-Cardin wound up, unfortunately, getting out of committee and then ultimately being passed. And that high watermark was when brave young Senator Tom Cotton, who, by the way, Audrey and your listeners should know, is the only sitting senator who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, did multiple tours. On March 9th, he managed to get 46 other GOP senators to sign what was called the Open Letter to the Leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It was published widely, including in the Wall Street Journal. And essentially, it simply reminded this theocratic totalitarian state of Iran, its leaders, its people, and it also reminded, you know, civic-minded U.S. citizens, a quote, that in the case of a treaty, the Senate must ratify it by a two-thirds vote. And in other words, the whole idea was that what the Obama administration appeared to be doing was outside the normal treaty-making processes of the Senate, which requires senatorial advice and consent. And this is particularly the way grave national security treaties are supposed to be handled. You know, the major negotiations, for example, with the former Soviet Union, which pertain to nuclear arms. And it's a very high bar. So in other words, you have to get any administration, any U.S. government, would, in negotiating something as sensitive as a nuclear arms agreement, would have to get two-thirds of the Senate to approve it. So it's a very – and it's an appropriately high standard. So what Corker Cardin, unfortunately, wound up doing, and I was shocked when I read the final – they call it – you know, Audrey, they call these things markups. Now I know why. You actually can see the bill now as a PDF file. And you see all the lines through various, you know, versions of it, iterations of it. At any rate, when that bill came out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on April 14th, I managed to get the full bill, you know, as any citizen can, and read through it very carefully. And I was shocked because I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I do read English. And there was a section entitled Effect of Congressional Action with Respect to Nuclear Agreements with Iran. And it stated very clearly on page 32, does not require a vote by Congress for the agreement to commence. So in other words, they were giving away one of their most sacred duties, obligations, privileges, which is advice and consent. They were formally giving it away. Now I was shocked to see this April 14th. Remember that, as I mentioned previously, remember that the letter that 46 of them had signed on to, along with Senator Cotton, was March 9th, and here we are, April 14th. So a little over a month later. And they've completely reversed course. So it comes out of committee, and there is an opportunity for various amendments to be debated, discussed, added. Although in retrospect, probably those things should have been done in committee, and that's where I fault Senator Rubio in particular, who's now running for president. I mean, he probably could have added some sort of a poison pill amendment in committee, and the whole thing would have blown up, and then we would have been back where we were in a much better position, you know, when all these people were rallying to Senator Cotton. Right. So I definitely fault Rubio, you know, for that. But at any rate, there is an attempt on April 28th to introduce an amendment, which was doomed, but at least it was, you know, it was an action that was initiated by Senator Ron Johnson. And it was an amendment which said, quote, to declare that any agreement reached by the president relating to the nuclear program of Iran is deemed a treaty that is subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. So basically, they're trying to write back in their own right, which they appear to have given up. That was voted down 39 yay, 57 nay. Now, at that point, at least Senator Rand Paul, who only recently dropped out and running for president, voted along with the 39. So that was to his credit. So where was Senator Cruz and Rubio? Mm-hmm. Well, they must have been out on the hustings or something. They didn't even vote on the amendment.
Wow.
Not even voting on the amendment. The next day, however, Senator Cruz managed to get an op-ed placed in the Washington Times. And, you know, as if none of this had happened, he says, thus, Corker-Cardin motion of disapproval reverses the ordinary presumptions. Instead of the president needing 67 Senate votes to ratify the Iran deal, it would now require 67 votes to stop an Iran deal. This makes no sense. Yes, but where were you? Where were you? Why did you give up where you were back on March 9th? Wow. So anyway, so he writes that op-ed, but at least he's, you know, acknowledging all this. Less than a week later, on May 6th, he was interviewed and he calls Corker-Cardin a bad bill. He adds, it's unlikely to stop a bad Iran deal. The issue, and he's talking about the Iran nuke deal, is far too important to send a bad bill simply to send a message. The legislation at best will slow down slightly a terrible deal. Don't have a fig leaf vote. This is May 6th. What does he do on May 7th? He votes for the Corker-Cardin the next day.
Wow.
And in fact, it's such a black mark on the entire Senate. It was 98-1 to approve the Corker-Cardin, essentially a capitulation. And of course, Rubio voted with him and Paul voted with him. So the other three that wound up running for president, the other two, all three of them voted. Only Tom Cotton, the whole way through, he was the one vote against it. And I just want your listeners to hear what Cruz said. So in other words, how Cruz rationalizes his complete volt-face, is a complete about face, one day apart. He says, ultimately, this is Cruz, ultimately, I voted yes on final passage because it may delay slightly President Obama's ability to lift the Iran sanctions, and it ensures we will have a congressional debate on the merits of the Iran deal. Yeah, well, we know how well that went, Audrey.
Yeah, right.
But in contrast, Cotton, the only vote against it, was interviewed the same day, May 7th, the day it passed. And he said, quote, a nuclear arms agreement with any adversary, especially the terror-sponsoring Islamist Iranian regime, should be submitted as a treaty and obtain a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate as required by the Constitution, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So the great constitutionalist Ted Cruz completely capitulated, and Senator Cotton, who, by the way, also graduated from Harvard Law School, did not. And I think that all these guys running for president, again, Paul has dropped out, but certainly now we're down to Cruz and Rubio. Mm-hmm. They really have to be held to task for this. Finally, Audrey, I just want to say that this was almost like the coup de grace. So months after this has taken place, so this is a fait accompli on May 7th, November 10th, 2015, and this is in an unrelated matter. It's about a controversial nominee for U.S. ambassador to Mexico. But Rubio had the temerity to proclaim about that issue, quote, I have always taken seriously my advice and consent role in the Senate, unquote.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you can't make up this kind of hypocrisy. And I just think that, you know, personally, for me, at this stage, I will vote, I will hold my nose and vote for whomever the Republicans, you know, put up. Because,
right.
You know, right now, the Democrats, I mean, it's become not only the Democratic Socialist Party, but in the case of Bernie Sanders, yeah. You know, might as well call them the Democratic Communist Party. And then we might at the last minute get the man who is so adamant he likes to swim naked in front of his female Secret Service.
Oh, my God. That's
widely reported by Biden. If he comes into the race, if Hillary gets, so you know, indicted, whatever. So I will hold my nose and vote for whoever the GOP puts up.
Right.
But I have to tell you, I am not enthusiastic about any of these candidates, and if I was voting in the New Hampshire primary at this point, I would clearly vote for Trump. It's a gamble, but you know, this kind of capitulation of your basic constitutional responsibility with all the mealy-mouthed excuses, particularly when someone like Senator Cotton, held fast throughout this whole period and set the proper example. There's no excuse for it as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Especially when you consider that Cruz, Rubio, and I know Paul's out of it now, where they profess to be constitutionalist, and how could they?
Especially Paul and Cruz. And you could see that Paul was having concerns when at least he went along with the doomed Ron Johnson amendment. But by then the horse is out of the barn, and in the end he votes for the bill. And Rubio, you know, it perhaps is not known as such a, you know, vociferous, you know, constitutionalist, but he is touted as a national security hawk. And on that basis, how could you go along with a vote like this? Even if you're not, you know, the constitutional purist that Paul and Cruz are touted to be. It's just really shocking to me to retrace how this transpired, and this is what all three of these senators who felt themselves qualified enough to run for president, this was their major foreign policy test when it comes to a concrete vote and to longstanding behaviors. Let's not forget that even if they could never muster 67 votes, They had an opportunity. I understand, you know, in the period before Corker Cardin came out of committee, that there was a lot of bipartisan support. There was about 60 people who really wanted this to go to be a treaty process. So obviously that's including Democrats. Of course, we ran through that experience with Menendez being sabotaged, et cetera. But there's no excuses for any of them. And instead of building a majority or a supermajority where they could have then threatened to do things like literally cutting off all the funding to the diplomatic mission. In other words, saying, look, we're not gonna fund all these trips back and forth to Vienna to hammer out such a dangerous agreement, even if it's only an executive agreement. We're just not gonna fund it. I mean, at a certain point, you have to take stances like that, Audrey. And so I say a pox on all of them except for Senator Cotton.
Exactly. I'm with you on that. And they have never exercised the power of the purse that the founders gave them, to push back against this administration and their policies. What a surprise.
Yeah, and if it's going to be, you know, called in hysterical terms, you know, a nuclear option. Well, you know what? This really was a nuclear option.
Exactly.
We're talking about a dangerously destabilizing nuclear deal. So if you're not gonna pull out all the stops on an issue like this, then as far as I'm concerned, you're worthless.
Yeah, spot on. Now, Andy, recently you wrote about an author from 1949 who made very overt connections between Islamic and 20th century communist totalitarianism. Can you share a little about that with us?
Yes. I was asked to give a speech, interestingly, about Islamic slavery and how it's balderized in secondary school textbooks, middle school textbooks, for a conference called the Education Policy Conference. And I thought as an interesting way to lead into it was to highlight the similarities between Islam and communism. And what you're referring to is a book that was published in 1949 by Jules Monnereau. And he dubbed the first chapter of his book. The book was called Sociology of Communism, but he dubbed communism as, quote, the 20th century Islam. And he said that it really shared two primary characteristics were shared by Islam and communism. He talks about conversion followed by subversion from within and the fusion of religion and state. And very specifically, he said communism takes the field both as a secular religion. See, he understood that. Mm-hmm. And as a universal state, it is therefore comparable to Islam. And then he talked about how each of these ideologies, these totalitarian ideologies, works outside their imperial frontiers to undermine the social structure of neighboring states. And I thought that was such a profound insight. But the part that was sort of picked up on by contemporary humorists, and I wish I could track down who they were, but their names remain anonymous, certainly to me, was this little aphorism, which apparently was popular in that era, again, the early 1950s. And it was, again, to highlight the similarities between Islam and communism. And the aphorism, so they do a takeoff on the confession of faith in Islam. You know, there is no God, there is no God other than Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Okay, so they take that, and the comic says, in referring to communism as a creed, says, quote, "There is no God, and Karl Marx is his prophet." and I just, it was a perfect encapsulation. But the piece was really about the horrors of Islamic slavery, right, and how it was sanctioned by jihad, how it was sanctioned by Islam's prophet Muhammad. It included mass rape. It included the aptly named hideous trade of eunuch slavery, a human gelding procedure to maintain these massive harems that the Muslims accumulated over 1,000 years. The practice didn't end until the early 20th century and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And then it also relates to what's going on right now.
Right.
I mean, there's chattel slavery in a large percentage of the Mauritanian population, which is an Islamic state. So it's Arab Muslims in the north and keeping enslaved both animists and black Muslims. And of course, ISIS's whole sex slavery. And even the recent sexual attacks that took place, the horrible attacks across Germany, particularly in Cologne, it's all part of the same phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to ask that you clear the confusion that most have been indoctrinated with from Western leaders and the media, in that they say that it's an aberration, jihad, sex slavery, but it actually is an accepted part of Islamic doctrine, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I went through how it's not just you know, with the formative period of Islam under Muhammad, who not only sanctioned the sexual slavery, he sanctioned as part of the victory actions, even mass rape. He personally sanctioned a mass rape, but it's you get contemporary jurists, both at the Sunni Vatican of Islam at Al-Azhar University, in this case, a female professor of theology, sanctioning modern era jihad slavery, sexual slavery in particular, and then jihad slavery more broadly, sanctioned by a Saudi cleric who helps write the Saudi school curriculum. So, this is not outside the mainstream by any stretch of the imagination. In Mauritania, where again a significant population, anywhere from 5 to 20% of the population, depending on the estimates, remains in chattel slavery, a very brave secular leaning Muslim abolitionist, or imagine they have to have abolitionists now, is still in prison for his actions trying to upend slavery in Mauritania. And at one point, when he protested, the president of Mauritania came out against him and called him an apostate for condemning modern era slavery. And what this very brave activist did, his name is Abide, he actually read one of the Maliki jurisprudence texts by Malik, who founded this school of Sunni law in the 9th century, and referring to some of the very derogatory things it said about slavery and about beating slaves as an example of the texts that have to be abandoned. And again, for doing such a thing, he was condemned as an apostate. He's been in and out of prison, but he's back in prison now.
Incredible. And of course, that is ignored. I mean, not by you, but the mainstream media and politicians, and ignore the fact that this actually happened, that it was brought out and it was condemned because he was telling the truth.
He's literally a modern day abolitionist, and he was trying to get at the source of the problem, you know, which is the jurisprudence on this. And, you know, there's another whole aspect to particularly Arab Muslim on either nominal Muslim black, black Muslims or animist black slavery. It's a whole racist element. You know, one of the greatest jurists and even considered a sociologist in Islam, in all of Islamic civilization, is Ibn Khaldun. And he wrote in a treatise in the Middle Ages, quote, the Negro nations are as a rule submissive to slavery because Negroes have little that is essentially human and possess attributes that are quite similar to those of dumb animals. So in other words, that was part of his justification for enslaving blacks in particular. And this is considered one of the most important Muslim intellectuals in the history of Islamic civilization.
Wow. I'm not surprised. I'm just, I guess I'm kind of stunned that that's out there. But of course, it's not going to be taken by the mainstream.
Well, you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, Ibn Khaldun died, I think, in 1406, but he is still revered as being one of the greatest intellectuals to ever contribute to Islamic civilization. And he does reflect the same school. He's also from that Maliki school, which is very influential in Africa, including in Mauritania, where lo and behold, we still see chattel slavery.
Sure. Sure. Very important question here, Andy. Where can listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books, including Iran's Final Solution for Israel, The Legacy of Shiite Islamic Jew Hatred in Iran?
The best place to go for my postings and things is at my website, which is just www.andrewbostom, all one word, .org. All of my books can be purchased including paperbound and ebook versions at Amazon.
Excellent. And of course, I'll have that information in all my social networks in my after show and soon on a permanent page on my website. So when Andy visits us on the show, you can go straight there to make connections. Thanks so much, Andy, for again sharing your brilliant assessments with us. And thank you for all you do for the cause of freedom. We look forward to your next visit. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.
Bye-bye, Audrey.